chair of the legislative committee, I'd like to go around the room and everybody introduce themselves for the record, please.
Latonya Lipson Smith, Ethics Commission.
Joseph Rogan, Ethics Commission, although I'm not a member of this committee. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Andrea Myers, Ethics Office.
Sandy Homerkhouse, Executive Assistant, Ethics Office.
Herbie Oberdorfer, Deputy Director, Ethics Office.
Ellen Schmidt, Ethics Commission, also not a member of the committee, but happy to join you today.
Paul DeVoe, Ethics Commission.
So we are expecting Councilman Dennis, and we'll just stop when he comes in, but I want to go ahead and move to the agenda. So we have the new business of proposal 2705, which he drafted. Mr. Oberdorf, I'd like to thank you for the nice summary that you put together for us.
Thank you.
And do you want to go through your summary for us for the team?
Certainly. So Council Member Dennis, from my understanding, approached the Office of General Counsel with the idea that he thought it would be beneficial to have political consultants in the city that are service consultants to elected officials and candidates to register with the council secretary, similar to what lobbyists are required to do under our local code. And you can see from the beginning of the legislation, the purpose of that is to protect the integrity and credibility of the electoral and governmental institutions, improve transparency, and try to assist the public in making informed decisions. And protect public confidence in electoral and governmental processes. So a lawyer in OGC that drafted this, I believe it was Paige Johnson, her name is on the back, she modeled this after a similar ordinance in San Francisco that was adopted back in the 90s. So most of the provisions in here in terms of the definitions and the requirements for the registration and the information that has to be provided comes from San Francisco, literally. She may have tweaked a term here or there. And then when you get to the back part of the bill, and I'll go through a little bit more detail what's in the bill, but when you get back to the back part of the bill, the last section, section 602.809, is the duties of the Ethics Commission. That a little bit comes from the San Francisco, and it also comes a little bit from the lobbyist registration code that we have here locally as well. So it's a combination of the San Francisco ordinance and also the registration requirements that are currently in the lobbyist registration code. It does add new sections into Part 8 of the Ethics Code. So it adds new sections 805 to 811. And essentially what it requires is anyone that is promised or received $1,000 or more annually for campaign management services or the development of political campaign strategy to register first with the council secretary before they can provide those services, and then to renew their registration annually every January 1st. And as part of their registration process and their updates that they have to make annually, they have to provide certain information that is set forth in part 602.808 starts on page 4 of the bill. And essentially that boils down to the names, business address, and phone number of themselves, their name of their employer and their employer's business activity, the names of individuals that they employ to assist them in providing consulting services, the name, address, and phone number of each client who has received services from them in the past 12 months, each individual political contribution of $100 or more for or against a candidate or measure made by the political consultant or their client in the preceding 12 months, any cumulative political contributions totaling over $1,000 in the prior 12 months, gifts totaling $100 or more made or promised by the consultant to elected officials that are designated in the code and that are on the summary, mayor, council, public defender, state attorney, sheriff, and school board, and then any other information you all would require. And it provides that if somebody fails to provide for the registration and gives services without registering first or doesn't update their information, it's a Class D offense, which in our local code is subject to a $500 fine and imprisonment by not more than 60 days or both.
Great, thank you. Any discussion, comments?
May I ask a question, a clarifying question? I'm not sure I understand exactly what a political consultant does. It sounds like there are people who help other people get elected to offices. Is there
Great, that's a great question. So yes, it's essentially people that help other people get elected to offices. And there is a particular definition on page 2 in section 602.806 of political consultants. First of all, it has a monetary requirement. They have to earn $1,000 or more each year from providing certain things. And that is either campaign management or the development and participation in campaign strategy. Those are further defined, campaign management, and provision D, 602.806D, and then the strategy is 806E. Essentially, campaign management means conducting, coordinating, or supervising a campaign, such as hiring staff, spending or raising, soliciting contributions, recommending vendors, those kind of things, the day-to-day operations, essentially, of a campaign. Whereas strategy is more geared towards campaign literature, authorizing the production and printing or broadcast of advertising campaign literature, seeking endorsements, and seeking financing, and developing policy positions.
Did you answer your question?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Any other discussion or comments?
I have a question.
I wish Councilman Dennis was here.
I was actually going to just email him these thoughts, but I figure if the committee is thinking about weighing in, I'd just bring them out. But for the definition there, I don't see, and Kirby, let me know if you do, I know you have no part in this, just because I know that you've studied this. I don't see any restriction that the service has to be for a local campaign. Right? If I live in Jacksonville and I'm working remotely for some consultant in Utah, I seem to trigger this and have to then file with council secretary.
I would agree that that is potentially a fair reading. There is something in here where it says periodically it uses the term local office holder. Which
But then the definition of what makes you register is not connected to local office holder.
That's correct.
It's really a definition that's there and that doesn't do anything.
Right.
The registration requirement, at least.
That's correct, right, because it's triggered only by part of the gift disclosure, I think.
Yeah.
Is one of them, but yes, I definitely agree with that. And in fact, one of the things that I noticed about it as they're going through the requirements for registration under section 602.808 on page 4 is there's this term client. Client is never defined.
It's not used anywhere
else. And it's not used anywhere else.
Yeah.
That does come. I did ask Paige about that, Ms. Johnston and OGC, and that comes from the language in the San Francisco. It was just pulled over but not further defined.
Yeah.
In this bill. So there is some clarity, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Did San Francisco have a definition for a client?
I don't believe so, but let me just double check. I had Sandy print these, the San Francisco for you. If the event you all, I do not see it in here. Wanted to get into it, but I didn't want to bog down the meeting and give you extraneous information if it wasn't relevant or germane to your discussion. But no, I just checked, there's not one in there.
Now, I was going to suggest, I was curious your thoughts, Kirby, on whether those 809 duties should really go to ECHO. And maybe you could leave D with the commission, but it's just, I don't know that it's feasible to have a 9-member citizen board really doing any of these 809 A through B.
It's going
to become like a primary duty. It's going to be a lot of work.
I would agree with that. And this is definitely something that came from the San Francisco legislation and was modeled in here, but it's not how our ethics program here in the city is developed and how it works on a day-to-day basis. So I would definitely agree with that. The other thing about those duties in 809B, it says that currently the commission is the one to preserve all registrations. That seems to conflict with 808A and B that requires the council secretary to get there.
So there definitely
needs to be some modification.
And then to further make that a little confusing, I thought my understanding of 811D is that the way they've structured the offense, it becomes enforceable only by the state attorney. So effectively, the ethics commission is writing all the procedures. The council secretary is the one receiving the registrations, but then the ethics commission has no authority to actually enforce any of this.
I think the ethics commission might be able to find a violation, but the enforcement mechanism would have to be through the state attorney's office. There are a lot of provisions in the ethics code that say that they're a class C or a class D offense.
So, but that would be an easy change, right? You could just put in 811D you could start it by saying a violation of this part constitutes a violation of this chapter and is punishable.
Correct. Yep. Yeah.
Anyway, those are my thoughts.
Yeah, those are great contributions. Kirby, is Councilman Dennis open to our, I mean, I know that we get to choose, but is he open, is he willing to have us make changes to his?
Yes, I think so. He's looking to you all for any improvements or recommendations that you might have for him and to kind of help him carry forth his vision, so to speak, if you will, in the best frame possible. He did mention that he was looking, you know, to get your substantive input.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so Kirby
They do have a website dedicated to this, and I did contact them on a number of occasions trying to find additional information about the types of cases or claims they would get and about whether this is working and how citizens may utilize the information, and I wasn't able to get anyone to respond to me. So that was one of the things that I was going to ask you all as a committee. If you were interested in trying to obtain some additional information, perhaps you might want to write a letter from our commission to their commission that might more get their attention than just me reaching out individually, but that's a really good thing. They have a dashboard. So San Francisco's is a little bit different in the sense of there are registration fees and client fees, so it's generating revenue for the city, number one, that the consultants pay in. They also have to have their clients sign an authorization statement. It's a pretty robust system. And then there was another significant difference between them, and I'm trying to refresh my recollection. Where's the
this looks like
it requires, I'm sorry, Joe, I didn't mean to cut you off. It requires the consultant to provide the earnings they are receiving per client each year and each quarter. So it's a lot of interesting. So the dashboard that you'll see on their website lists the consultants, the client, how much money they received, how much money they were promised, how much money they received, whether they got any gifts. So it's collating all this information. And none of that, except for the gifts part, was carried over into this one.
I was going to say, it looks like their IG, Echo, and Auditor all falls under their ethics. They have, according to their website, 29 staff
yes.
that are working for their ethics. So that makes a little more sense why they would have it structured like
they
this.
Have
Sherry's going to be really busy.
That's why I'm asking all these questions. Okay, what did they do in San Francisco?
That's a good question.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I seem to have sensed from the San Francisco model that they have some type of sliding scale for fees.
They do. So the registration fee is a flat fee. It's $50. But the client fee is dependent upon how much revenue you're generating in political consulting fees if you're the consultant. So,
it sort of is, right.
So, by way of example, if you are a consultant that earns at least $1,000, but not more than $5,000 per year, you pay $50 per client. If you earn $5,000, but not more than $20, you pay $50 per client. And if you earn more than $20,000 a year, you pay a registration fee, of $400, so your registration fee goes up. Oh, it's the client fee that stays the same, it's the registration fee that applies. Sorry, I got this backwards. So it goes from $50 if you make $1,000 to $5,000 for the registration, $200 registration if it's $5,000 to $20,000 each year for your income off of it, and then If you make $20,000 or more, you pay a $400 registration fee. So it's a pretty robust system.
And Carlton and Tommy, did you guys have any other comments? Can you agree with that?
Not without counseling.
The only thing that I had a couple of questions. I left my full thing of notes and I brought my second page of notes. I don't know why. But I did notice under 602.808 on page 4, number 3, earlier they say that employees of the political consultant will not be included, but here it's the names of any individual who's our employee. And so I think that's a concept as well.
I thought about that as well, and I really struggled with that, and then when I read it for like the third time, I think what they're saying is, if you are an employee, you're not required to register. But if you're the main consultant, when you register, you are required to provide the names of the employees working for you.
And when I read it, and I read it a couple of times, I thought that they really meant the names of any subcontractors that were working for them. Mm-hmm.
So under individuals?
Yeah.
Names of any individuals employed by the political consultant.
Right.
So, yeah.
No,
it's definitely not
I
clear.
I could see that as my best, subcontractor. I could see that. Absolutely.
So that was one thing I noticed. I think the other thing was on page 5. Let's see. Oh, my question was actually for Councilman Dennis. If this is supposed to be effective on January 1st of 2021, then what is the plan for this year? Right? Is this, maybe we should change it to 2022?
Yes.
Or maybe there's some process in there that
it's not going to be effective. It's not effective
right.
Now. Yeah. This would have to be enacted by City Council. So whenever they enact it, then if it becomes effective when the mayor signs off on it, or 10 days after he doesn't sign off on it, it'll become effective. Yeah.
Right. I would still have that question of, let's say, if it became effective, regardless of the method, mayor or 10 days after. If it became effective in October, what are they going to do for January through October of 2021?
Right.
That's kind of my concern.
Okay.
Although maybe that prospective effective date is to allow the Ethics Commission to develop all the procedures and forms and hire the staff that we're going to need.
It was 20 some odd staff members.
You have to add like directions to the staff or something in the legislation.
Yeah.
My only other concern is that I thought it was a bit much to add to the responsibility of the commission,
mm-hmm.
and that certainly I think would be better placed with the ECHO office. Right? Because then it requires us to do a lot of record keeping, and I don't think we're the right people to do that type of record keeping.
Well, Kirby, how was the ethics? So is it their staff to the Ethics Commission in San Francisco, or is it the I guess they have like 29 or whatever
right.
staff to their ethics commission there as opposed to the professor. Okay. And this is the only ordinance that we know of and that's in San Francisco. I mean, anywhere else around the country that Paige may have researched or...
She mentioned there's one in Portland, Oregon and the state of New York, but she didn't model it after that one. That's
okay.
All she mentioned. And I did not further research those.
If I remember correctly, Portland, Oregon has a pretty robust ethics commission.
It does. Much like San Francisco.
I'm not sure what this question is for, but I'm wondering if within the city there's any other similar registration process for
lobbyists, yes.
And how is that managed?
That's managed by, I think, legislative services. They have to register every month or something like that. And then Kirby, isn't it posted on the website? It's posted on the website once they register. And those are lobbyists, though. So lobbyists are different. According to this, it's sort of different from the political.
Section 602.801 of the code is what has the lobbyist, and that's in one of your last attachments, I think. And that system is managed through legislative services for City Council, but it's actually jointly owned between our office and City Council. The lobbyists are required to register on an annual basis. on this app
oh,
that
so
was
it's not monthly.
No,
oh,
it's annual.
Okay. Thanks for the correction.
An annual basis through this app that the University of North Florida developed. So it is all online.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quirk in the system that they can't re-register before they expire, and then they can only register after their registration expires. It's something we're working on. We did not develop it.
Right.
So UNF developed it, their computer department, and then gave it to ITD. So there's some bugs in the system we've been trying to work out. But essentially, that's what it is. They're supposed to register their client and their issue, their name, their address, before they try to influence decision-making at the local government level. So long as they fall into the category of a lobbyist, which is typically somebody that's paid as a compensation. But the last provision in 801, it's D or E, lists five different exemptions of people that don't classify as lobbyists, and that's a rather large class of people.
Thank you. I was asking because I was thinking, was there anything in that process, if there was another process that we could mirror or steal or learn from?
That's a really good question. And the only thing I could think of that would be even remotely close would be the lobbyist. And so the registration provisions and 6 and 705, the bill that you're talking about now, does come, is mirrored off of 801
mm-hmm.
In terms of the process and the procedure. But it requires much more extensive information from the consultants than is currently required from the lobbyist.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Any other discussion or comments on 2020-705? Shall we move to 2018-570, the legislation that was filed by Ms. Boche when she was councilwoman on the travel? If you all remember, we've had kind of lots of debate mm-hmm. about this.
That's a great question. There's no set or formula or process for doing it. It's however you're comfortable with. So you can draft a series of questions for him if you wanted further discussion, or you could work on proposed language and give it to him to review. There's different, I think, methods by which you could do it. You can have another notice meeting and see. I was just looking at my phone to see if he'd emailed me or texted me. Usually he will if he's getting caught up in something, and I don't see anything from him. But, you know, see if maybe if you wanted him to be here to talk to you about it further, we could try to arrange another meeting, whatever you all are most comfortable with, you think is the best way to approach it.
Do you think it's better that we, I know that he's the kind of the one who's cheerheading it, but maybe we should talk to Paige, have Paige here too?
Yeah, we could do that for sure. Yeah.
And then maybe for each of the areas where we've had concerns or made notes, we can start brainstorming some ideas to flesh it out and make it a little bit more clear,
mm-hmm.
whether in this meeting or the next.
Yeah.
Madam Chairman, you may consider asking Kirby or Jerry to talk with either Councilman Dennis's ECA or Paige and just sort of relay these high-level thoughts. Because what I don't know is whether Councilmember Dennis is looking for the commission's endorsement or just thoughts. So this may be all the feedback he needs. And then if he's looking for a sort of formal resolution or something, then he can make the changes, come back, and show it to the commission and ask for whatever he wants.
Okay.
Just a thought. Yeah.
So Ms. Pogg and Ms. Overdorf, would you all be willing to go back to council and find out?
Absolutely, and I can get with Paige as well. I guess we
certainly.
Can just set up something.
Yeah, that'd be great. And Paige should definitely be there
yeah.
since she drafted it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
So I suggest after we hear back from you guys, then we can act accordingly.
Yeah.
So, to 2018-570, any comments or discussion on this bill? Mm-hmm.
it just failed, or
yes.
was withdrawn? Okay. So,
there was a lot of, if I remember correctly, there was a lot of issue going on about that time, right?
There was.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I got a lot of memory.
Yeah.
I do remember the hoopla.
Oh, yeah.
I don't,
see, there it is. Oh, okay.
I don't recall the vote being very close on this bill.
Neither do I.
I think it's.
Yeah.
On 570?
Yes, on 570, yeah. And that we provided, we being the office, provided as a template on the last part of the bill, pages 8 and 9, is where there's the discussion about disclosure of travel, specifically subsection D on page 9, where it's being paid by a political action committee. So, this was as a sample template to let you know about legislation that had previously been introduced to council to try to get additional disclosure on travel and gifts related to the Atlanta cases that you all have discussed. This legislation is not related to that, but it's the same type of issue. So it's provided to you as a template. And so you could, if you wanted to, vote to adopt this, you know, as it is, and that's, you know, try to have somebody reintroduce that. Or there were additional concerns that I put in the email to everybody that were discussed, and I went back and listened to the tapes of all the Ethics Commission meetings, the full commission meetings on those cases, and listened to everybody's feedback about concerns or issues they had or things they might want to see in legislation. And there were 7 different categories of information. So I just wasn't certain as a committee what your preference would be in terms of whether you want to limit disclosure only to when it's paid by a political committee, or if you also wanted to address these other topics that had come up during the course of the Atlanta cases. So.
Yeah, I like when we talk about these 7 that came up, because I think if we don't, they're going to be recurring issues. If we can nip it in the bud and get it moving, then I think we should do that.
Okay.
So the issue for timely issued invoices for cost of travel. I think if I recall correctly, is that some invoices were issued early on and some were issued quite late.
That's correct.
Yes.
So what do people think is an appropriate time for issuance of?
I may be remembering incorrectly, but is there even a rule about having to issue an invoice?
No.
There's not even
no.
a rule that says an invoice has to be issued, and that
so
would be
so it tends to just rely on the gift recipients
to ask,
you know, candor
mm-hmm.
or diligence.
Mm-hmm.
The mom and me makes me say, "That's not going to work. That's not going to work."
Being a surprise to me that there was no rule that said you had to provide an invoice when you provided a gift, and then whatever sort. I don't think I was just getting a sense of travel, but.
So, in our current rule, do we have anything about invoice issuing at all?
We do not. So, all of your current rules on gifts are in one of the handouts you should have called Relevant Jacksonville Ethics Code Provisions, and we can kind of flip through those real quick, but it's real short what we have on that, and it starts on page 2 is the definitions of gifts, and then page 3 and 4. Page 3 and 4, the local definitions of gifts, and then on page 2 are only the restrictions, or the only regulations, rather, about gifts. So it has to deal with, so this is a handout titled Relevant Jacksonville Code Provisions for Ordinance 2027-05. And then on page 2, it starts the one for disclosure of travel and gifts. And I've laid out for you or included for you the 3 relevant provisions that the only restrictions or rules about gifts and travel, or gifts rather, are right here. And primarily it has to do with the dollar amount. It's regulating who you can get it from, which is a lobbyist or vendor, and prohibits it if it's over $100. That's essentially, or $250 cumulative in a year. And that's essentially what the prohibition is. That's the only rule.
And so does the committee feel as a whole that we should add a definition or some type of rule regarding invoicing?
Yes.
I agree. I also recall that you could pay any way you wanted, including cash, and we had talked about, would a better method be to require the reimbursement for the gift to be in some electronic manner that could be tracked or proven if needed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know how y'all feel about that, but I remember it came up as a point of discussion.
Yep. Yeah, that's point number four.
Oh, gosh,
sure.
I should read more.
No, you're not.
I didn't, and I like ran over here like a lunatic sweating crazy. So at least I did remember correctly.
Because the corollary to that, right, was that some people did actually cut the checks and then they weren't positive.
Mm-hmm. Or payment was made not to a spouse, right? And I think that's all that stuff.
Yeah, there was Venmo.
But the spouse one, I think, is difficult. Well, so spouse is not difficult, right? But I have seen where, and I actually had this, where I received a gift where somebody that I work with at a different firm brought me to an event that had an amount, and he would not accept the reimbursement. And so I had to consult the ethics office, and they said that you can ask him where I can send it on his behalf, and he picked a charity. And so I made that donation. So you don't want to totally prohibit them from designating a recipient, because then what you do is you put the gift recipient in a position of not knowing what to do if the gift giver says, I don't want your money.
Yeah, and so that's a good point, but I think a spouse not connected to the business and not subject to the rules, I think is different.
It definitely seems different. I was just trying to think of, and maybe we could just rely on our lawyers to figure it out, but how you could...
I love having lawyers.
How do you sort of prohibit that designee without prohibiting the designee in my in my example?
Yours is a great example, but again, what we were faced with is that one of the respondents had used a Venmo account of the wife. If you recall, it was the wife's Venmo account, and I believe one of them also said that the wife actually gave them allowance.
Oh, yes.
You remember that?
Yeah.
So they never used credit cards, or they never used Venmo. They just paid everything with cash, because that's how they... So, those are things you have to also think of. That's certainly not the same as... You're just a perfect example of what you use, but...
We're in the 2000s, not the 1930s.
Right. And it could change from here, because I saw an ad or something about, I don't know, there's some app that you use and you never, it shows how to use your money. And so it's continuing to evolve how people pay for stuff.
I just keep thinking of older folks, this might not be applicable, but could we keep that cash could be used as a payment, but then have something else as a requirement, right? That it would need to be accompanied with
contemporaneous receipt.
Correct.
I was thinking sort of the same thing. It's like, what if you're on like day 89 and I happen to be here, I received a $110 gift, so I can pay down $11, and my choices are either to give charity the $11 that I've got in my wallet right now, or to miss the 90 days.
So I think we definitely do need something to cover those contingencies, but I think we need some options.
Mm-hmm. Right. I thought it was crazy at the time, Madam Chair, but my kids lost the keys to the mailbox, and so you have to pay cash at the Postal Service, and so what they do is they lay your cash in the application and make a copy, and then give that back to you. Exactly what I thought at the time, but the U.S. Postal Service is doing that as proof of cash payments.
That's really interesting.
You could sue them, but they're probably immune.
Yeah.
I just wanted my key to the mailbox.
Actually, I have a client right now who can't get a key to a mailbox. It's a probate case, but it's quite interesting. I don't know what the time is at this point.
I wonder something like put in, I was thinking back to Councilman Dennis's legislation where the Ethics Commission was going to promulgate rules and regulations. Could you do something similar and defer that to ECHO with the consent of OGC so that, you know, ECHO works with OGC to come up with specifics like that rather than us trying to figure out precisely how somebody's going to pay and then have to evolve that. Let's say we put in here no cash and then the, you know, interest rates skyrocket, people stop using credit cards and mm-hmm. checks are already phasing out, cryptocurrency's coming in.
Cryptocurrency is coming, I was going
to
mention that.
And so if we sort of allow our, you know, professional staff to the flexibility to set those rules, maybe that's the way to do it.
That's somewhat consistent with what happens at the State Ethics Commission level. So there's a Florida statute, obviously, on the regulation of gifts, and then there's a whole host of regulations adopted by the commission that informs what those mean, as you actually discovered, Amani, during the Atlanta cases, where the definition mm-hmm. of the comparable commercial conveyance is that unrestricted fare. That's not in the statute. That's in those regs. So, yeah, that would
And so if you do that, you can put in the legislation that it's going to take in effect to give people a year grace period where ECHO can develop the rules and regulations, go train everybody, you know, on this new thing, because everybody's used to the, you know, cash transaction, so to speak, with a pan receipt if necessary later.
That's a good idea, and I'm, you know, I'm quite comfortable with our very capable lawyers in hand to develop something like that.
My question, and it's perhaps answered in the state legislation, Kirby, so this is confusing to my non-lawyer brain. There's section 602.703, which talks about the prohibited offering of gifts. And it says it's a violation of this chapter for a lobbyist, blah, 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 to knowingly offer a gift to an officer or employee of the city of an independent agency, which would cause a violation of section 602.701 if accepted. And then it says in 602.701 that you can't accept a gift, any one gift greater than $100 or in a calendar year $250. And so I keep trying to figure out, like, how can you ever give me a gift that's worth more than $100 without triggering 602.703? But I get that you're allowed to pay the gifts back, but it doesn't really say in here that you pay it back.
That's right. That's actually
that
a rule that only
terribly.
Exists at the state level. It's actually built into the state statute, 112.3148, about the 90 days, and it's built into their definition of a gift. It is not one that exists currently at the local level. So one interpretation is once that gift is given, period, it's a violation. There is no 90 days to pay it down.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. not how the commission here locally has generally interpreted that. They've looked at the interpretation at the state level and adopted that as a matter of kind of course and practice, but it's not codified in there, and that was one of the issues that you all discussed during the Atlanta cases of adding that to our 701, maybe.
And if we were going to tackle it, that might be something to do. So it's clear that you're not in violation of 602.70. You're not in violation of either of them if by the end of the 90 days you paid back all but $100.
Right.
Do you have to pay $10.99 or you pay back?
You
like
can
if
pay
you gave
it
me a $150 gift and I gave you $50, I'd be good.
You can pay $100.
Nobody's giving me any money, by the way. I got nothing. So.
It can't be over $100, so you can pay $100. We often, as a best practice, instruct people to pay
$99. Give the dollar.
So that is very clear, and there's no legal and, you know, difficulties in that.
Or to pay it down entirely. So
right. That's another option.
Well, certainly, I think that needs to be clarified as well. Thank you, Alan, for reminding us. So so ECHO will, with OGC, kind of spearhead for the campaign. And did we agree at our former meeting that it would coordinate our local with the state for the 90 days?
There was no agreement. There was discussion about maybe wanting to do that, but I don't recall an agreement from going back to listen to the discussion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Can't vote.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Any public?
Oh, you remember public comment. Very good.
Okay. Timely issued, received, approved. This is kind of all wrapped in together.
Thank you for sharing.
Sure, no, absolutely. Yes, yeah, so the timely issued invoices, and the timely issued receipts of proof of payment and not permitting the cash, all of those could definitely be part of the regulations. Valuation, that could be put in the code, or it could be part of the regulations, or both. At the state level, it's both. It's in the code, and it's also, it's in the statutes, and it's also part of the state ethics commission regulations. So that's entirely up to you all how, and whether or not you want to include something about valuation.
You know, I think my thoughts are that we should, right? Because that fine line discrepancy last year of trying to fly really close under the radar, where if there was a careful reading of the statute, there was a $300 difference. I think we should definitely have the commercial one in there.
Okay.
Right? We're really trying to be, have people be transparent,
mm-hmm. right?
Right, and be forthright. And so I think if you leave some valuation to actual cost, if they could be doing actual cost on a volume discount or on some type of an affinity program.
Right.
Wherein, you know, I know if I make travel through our corporate travel, not only do they get something, but we get reduced prices, plus we get all these extra perks that go along with that.
So the reason that's absolutely right. And the reason that this rule was developed at the state level is because there was a case out of Miami where U.S. Sugar Corporation was flying to Tallahassee to lobby, and they were already going, and so they said, okay, Ellen, you're our lobbyist, come along with us. There's no actual cost to U.S. Sugar Corporation to put Ellen on the plane. The plane was already going, it was already purchased with the fuel, the staff was already, so it was a zero cost. So legislators and lobbyists were constantly flying back and forth, and so that's how the comparable commercial conveyance rule was adopted, as opposed to the actual cost. In the Atlanta cases, there was a concern that the comparable commercial conveyance was below the market value cost of the charter plane. So there was discussion in terms of whether you wanted to include valuation or whether it should be the comparable commercial conveyance or whether it's actual cost. But if there is no cost comparable, so there are different ways that you all can do it and just different considerations.
What I like, and you know, I know that I stirred the pot on that with the fine reading. I know, I'm really good at that these days. But you get a lot of people riled up, feathers flying all over the place. You know, I do think it is a good metric, right? Because then there's no, you can't mold and play with it and, you know,
mm-hmm.
get it right into where you want.
Right.
And those commercial rates, they're verifiable.
Right.
100% of the time, all the time, it never goes away.
That's right.
And so it's, you're tried and true right there.
I have a thought on that, Madam Chair.
Okay.
May I get a thought?
Of course.
So what we're talking about, and I think that makes total sense, is using real value as opposed to value to the donor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is, just so we know, and I don't think it's a bad thing, but that is a deviation from state law. And so this is going to be a point where our elected officials are going to have to do two different things, depending on whether they're reporting to us or reporting to the state. At the state, it's about value to the donor, and it's going to sound like I get gifts all the time. For us, I've gotten three gifts in my 5 years on the commission, and I'm about to tell you about the second of the three. Right? Where I had a friend who had a friend who was a distributor for some scotch maker, right? And so gave to my friend as a marketing tool a $120 bottle of scotch. He doesn't like scotch, and he gave it to me, right? And so the value of that gift, as I reported it to the state, even though I don't think I needed to, but the value of that gift is zero because he didn't pay for it. So that would be a circumstance where I don't have to disclose it to the state, but I do have to disclose it locally. And I think that's fine. I don't see any issue with that. I just think if we're going to go that route, we need to be really open and transparent about what we're doing so that we don't gotcha people who are trying their best to follow the laws, and this is just one where the state and local would be.
And certainly I don't want people to think that we're looking for the gotcha, right?
Sure.
It's not our intent. The intent is really to be transparent and open and
But to your point, wouldn't that be cleared up in training?
I think it would. And I think using actual value makes sense. Because in that circumstance, even though the gift meant nothing to him, I didn't know he got appropriated. And so from my perspective, maybe it's a $120 gift. Mm-hmm. And so I think using donor value creates gamesmanship for all the reasons mm-hmm. Monty was talking about, that the more that your company flies, you can use that to get around, other things. Or like, no, I didn't pay for this charter plane, right? I paid for the last 10, so this was my freebie. I got my stamp card, and so then the value of this gets to zero. And so you get around that by using actual value or just value or commercial rate, regardless of actual price. I think that makes sense. It's just something that Echo would have to really pay attention to, so that when they're trained or elected officials, they know there's a difference between what they have to disclose to the state and what they have to disclose here.
So how does the community feel about that difference of state versus local?
Personally, I think that your recommendation is more accurate. And it might be something that the communications we have with the State Ethics Commission, that they may see that we've taken that step and maybe they should follow suit.
So certainly I think we'd like to wrap that in for the legislation, but I think we'd also like to hear about ways that we can address situations in this real world, right? Because we don't want to have these situations where people are, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
Right? We want to be really, really clear, yet we want to have some level of, I don't want to use the word flexibility, but we want to have some discretion as to, I'm not even sure that's the best word for it, but flexibility, we need to have some flexibility with that, right? Because we don't want to have situations like that where you're given something that is of no value, and then you're torn between how do I report or what do I report.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And something, one way you may be able to address that is by saying that it doesn't kind of wordsmith this, it's just kind of stream of consciousness, but if what you're doing is fine under state law and is only a problem under local law, then it's a disclosure requirement and not punitive, right? So, in that circumstance, so we're not going to fine you for something that was fine under state law. We just want you to, so essentially it's an increased disclosure, but that it's only punitive if it also violated state law. That could be one way to maybe address it. And I think disclosure is actually more important than the $500 fine anyway.
It really is.
Goes to the whole discussion of credibility that various members of the community brought up
mm-hmm.
at our meetings and the editorials all the time.
Mm-hmm. And candor. That's a lot most important, at least in our world, right? You've got to be candid with people and candor. In law school, that means if you cheat on a paper, you say, I cheated on the paper, and this is why I cheated. Any further discussion on that?
May I ask for just a point of clarification? So currently in your local code, the 602.701 to 703, there is no disclosure requirement. So I think I'm sensing, but I just want to confirm that you all would like to add a disclosure requirement?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And so then as I'm thinking about that and how that gets disclosed, they'll have to be, so the code prohibits any gift, the code and state law, they're the same, any gift from a lobbyist or a vendor that is in excess of $100, a one-time gift, or locally, cumulatively, $250 or more in a series of gifts in a year. And so I'm just trying to think about, at the state level where they file their gift disclosure forms, they're not disclosing any gift that's in excess of that amount because that's an illegal gift. Right, so they're not disclosing that. So I'm just wondering how what the threshold of the disclosure is. Right, so now you would only be having them disclose anything under $100.
No.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think
example was, is an easy one, right? So somebody gave me a gift and the value to them was zero, so I didn't have to report it to the state at all. But under our rules, if we're going to use a flat $100 based on the fair value of the object, and so I have to report it now to Echo, but not to the state.
Mm-hmm.
In my circumstance, I've reported it to the state just because I wanted to be careful, but that's sort of the idea.
Yeah,
and then the lack of pay down actually makes sense.
But in your example, it's not a lobbyist or a vendor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in that situation, it doesn't matter what the level of gift is. The disclosure could be whether it's $1 or $100, you can have a threshold.
Mm-hmm.
But if the gift is coming from a lobbyist or a vendor, you're going to only be asking them to disclose a gift valued under $100, because anything over $100 is illegal.
Okay.
They can't accept that. So they're not disclosing that at the state level on their Form 9, because nobody is encouraging them to disclose an illegal gift. They should be paying that down. And then you would have them disclose the remainder that they didn't pay down, if they paid down. I'm just thinking practically.
Right. But in my circumstance, so let's say the donor was a lobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
That
yes.
would be, that was a legal gift under state law, a legal gift,
yes.
because the donor value is zero, but I'd have to report it locally.
Well, when they gave you the scotch, did you call Claudia or Carla about it?
Yes.
So it was related to your position as an ethics commissioner?
It was not.
Gifts are not that.
Okay.
The definition of a gift is not limited to your official government position.
Okay.
And that's actually, we train on that, because so many people think, oh, if I only get it because I'm on the commission, or if they said, you're doing such a great job on the commission, here's this gift. And that's oftentimes not what happens. People come into government having pre-existing relationships with people that ended up being lobbyists or vendors, and if they've exchanged gifts their whole life,
what was your recommendation?
Now they can't.
What did you recommend?
Send you the written opinion if you want.
Well, no. Okay, so you did write an opinion. Okay.
All right. The recommendation was he may not have been legally required to disclose it, but out of transparency purposes, it didn't hurt to disclose it,
right.
which is often
the
advice that's given by the State Ethics Commission, and that actually came directly from the State Ethics Commission, so that was the advice that I gave.
And I went back to the donor at Kirby's suggestion and made sure that his company does not do business with the city. Because if they were a lobbyist or vendor of the city, then it would be a more important question.
Mm-hmm.
For here, it didn't matter that I received the gift,
right.
So might as well just report it.
Right. So I'm just trying to think about if we take, for instance, the cases that prompted this discussion that we're having today, there was payments, they were all paid down, right, up until whatever the amount was. So let's add the disclosure level on top of that. What are they disclosing? Are they disclosing the value was $700 and they paid $600? They're disclosing $100, or are they only...
I see what you're saying. Because what we're talking about is that essentially it would become an illegal gift because of the actual value, but then we negated that when I said it's just going to turn into a disclosure if it doesn't violate state law.
Right.
So then, yeah, I see what you're saying now.
So now I'm just trying to, if you're going to include disclosure, which is okay, you could do that, what are you asking them to disclose so that it's not triggering some type of violation of the code? That's what I'm trying to very inartfully work out as I'm sitting here. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm understanding correctly, but if I was a citizen, which I am, and I would be interested in knowing the full value as the disclosure, like if my councilman went on a trip that was worth $1,000 that somebody spent a day giving them, wining and dining them, then my councilman had to pay.
Regardless of pay down, you're saying?
Right. I think I'd want to know what the whole value of the thing was, rather than that he paid back. I'm confused about what each of these $900.
$900,
I want to know what it was all
for.
Yeah. And you get to use donor's value.
And it also is like a booty prize. Like, what kind of gift is that? You have to pay it all back, but of course it's the right thing to do. I have another tangentially related
question. And there may just be, that's a fair point. We'll definitely have to obviously run this through OGC. There may be a legal reason why you're not asking them to disclose things if they're not paying them down, right? there's a legal reason why they're not being required at the state level to disclose a legal gift they're if they're receiving a legal gift. I'm not saying anyone in these cases receives one, but there could be some implications to that.
But when you do your tax returns, the IRS requires you to report all income through legal and illegal means. So I think really, to Ellen's point, what we're looking for and what the community is looking for is a disclosure of what the total gift is and then verification that they did in fact pay it down to that amount. And if we're going to try to build trust with our elected officials, right, we want to show that folks are, yes, I got a gift of this amount, but within the allotted time I paid it down to that $99.
I think that's great. And you could essentially drop the entire punitive aspect of the local gift laws, right? Just leave the whole punitive aspect of gifts to the State Ethics Commission. And locally, you just make it a straight disclosure requirement. Pay down doesn't matter. If you received a gift, you disclose it based on actual value and how much you paid it down.
That makes it a lot easier. Straightforward.
Very transparent.
Very transparent. Looking back.
I answered my own tangentially relative question by reading.
Oh, cool.
So I've learned.
Okay. Number. I'm ordering you to put Carlton on the other side of me next time. Okay. Elimination of knowing in time. What was our discussion around that? But I do remember we had a great detailed discussion about that. I just can't remember what the actual discussion was.
Is it from 603703?
It is.
To knowingly offer a gift?
Yes. So that, I think, came back, as I recall, and I may not be summarizing this correctly, so I'm going off my recollection, but that was an issue that was raised in some of the written materials from the attorneys that were representing the lobbyists, and whether or not they knowingly gave an illegal gift if they were telling people how much it was and asking them to pay it down. So there was a legal intent. Right now, it requires a legal intent of knowing to have a violation of that. And so the question from the commission was, did you want to retain that, or do you want it to be just, if you do it, it's a violation?
I think the discussion was, about running a stop sign, right? You can see a stop sign, and it could be behind a bush that is in the exact shape of it, and you can go through, but the police officer that is there is still going to give you a ticket, right? Because you didn't stop. And you can say, well, I didn't see the bush, but that does not matter, right? You get the ticket because you didn't stop.
Just my face.
It's like being
pregnant.
You can't
it all
be
then.
Partially pregnant, right? You either are pregnant or you are not
right.
Pregnant. There's no kind of about it.
Yeah. So in your example, you inadvertently went to the stop sign because you didn't realize it was there, but you still
went to the stop sign. So if you had the disclosure requirement, you don't have that issue. And it's not about knowing, it's about strict liability.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not about what do you mean when you're the stop sign. It's about whether you went to the stop sign or not.
If Madam Chair, it would seem to me that if we remove the knowing requirement, that really is more in line with the disclosure requirement that we're recommending.
I'm
horrible
with analogies, but I am in agreement with Mr.
Does that mean, do you end up violating this if you don't know the person's a city official? Is that what the knowing is, as opposed to knowing that the gift is too much?
I thought the discussion was about knowing about the gift, not about the city official.
No, I know how the respondents argue about the knowing requirement. I'm just wondering if maybe there's some clarity. You don't want to gotcha that I didn't know that person was on the Human Rights Commission. It's different when it's like a council member. Everybody knows that or the mayor. Mm-hmm. It's not the same if somebody works in, military affairs or happens to be on some board or commission,
mm-hmm.
public service grant council. So maybe you just clarify that knowing is,
yeah.
knowing you know that you gave the gift, first of all, and you know that the person's a city official. Or what is the trigger? Is it a city official?
It doesn't say. It just says, let's see, to knowingly offer a gift to an officer or an employee of the city. This
officer
is on page
employee.
Two, yeah.
So you know that they're an officer or employee, you know you gave the gift.
Which not a whole lot of people know that they're a city employee right off the bat like that.
Clear from the discussion, I guess, what the direction, what your preference would be.
Definition of what knowing is.
I'm just
going
to say that.
And would the lobbyists invite you out before you being who you are for the city? So.
Nobody has yet just blindly offered me a gift on the street.
Good point. Good point.
They know you're connected to something.
It's not entirely, this is not going to come up all that often.
Yeah. No one's even offered me a piece of gum yet.
But my suggestion would be that the knowing applies to that they're an officer or official in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And we can leave to our council how to make that happen.
Yeah.
So, and you could just say to offer a gift to a person the lobbyist, principal, or employer knows is a officer
mm-hmm.
or employee.
And then mandatory training for lobbyists. I think it's absolutely required.
There is no current requirement.
Right. We need to make a requirement that they can train.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're dealing with the city, they need to train. That way we can avoid silly arguments.
I did not have the discussions with them, but I believe the agreement was to work with the commission to develop legislation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was for training, too.
It could have been.
I support, which is, if the lobbyists have to register, then could they get a packet of information? Do they already get a packet of information when they register that talks to them about the rules? And then how frequently is it possible for training to occur? Like, could it occur without putting an undue burden on the office every 3 months for people who are newly registered? Is that insane? I'm wondering about the training. So I register as a lobbyist on July 1st, and the next training is in January. How do I know what to do? A packet of information with the rules that I should be responsible for reading?
Don't you guys do training on a regular basis?
We do training on a regular basis for boards and commission members. They are required by the ordinance code to get 1 hour of training every 4 years, and we offer it on a bi-monthly basis. So we offer it every other month. We do new employee training every month, and we train city council annually. And so we do have written materials like manuals that you all got at the last meeting, the boards and commissions manual, which we could do for lobbyists, and then we could do something virtually or online or something like that. And I would defer to Andrea because she's our training expert, but where it wouldn't be too much of a burden, I think, on the office. Andrea, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I was thinking modeling it off of some of those existing programs that we have. There's a manual. You acknowledge in writing that you have read and understood the manual before you begin lobbying, and then you're required to maybe attend training with. Yeah, I can give different requirements.
have to vote without training. You know, and if we have training that's every other month, then they should be required to have some 60 days to get training or 90 days to get training.
Is there ever such a thing as you do a training and it's brilliant and you're videotaped and video at this point digitally recorded because I'm 100 digitally recorded and then available for people to watch at their convenience? Would that be a thing or you hate that?
We do not
something in your eye.
Make that an offer.
Okay.
Well,
maybe
I would. Well, I thought they were required to do in person training, right?
Yeah. Typically we would ask that they come in person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we feel like it's important for them to build a relationship with our office. However, there are some instances where people say, like, they just can't come to board the commission's training during the day. And so if they make the effort to reach out to us and explain their situation, then we might provide, you know, on a case-by-case basis, a video. And we'll ask them to, in writing, acknowledge that they actually did, you know, watch the entire video.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll give them a knowledge check to prove that they watched the video.
And it could just be not a great idea. It was just a thought that popped into
yeah.
my head.
Yeah.
Is it possible to have Echo offer training in the evening once per month or every other month?
Every 6 months?
Yeah, certainly. We have offered it in the past. The only issue with that was lack of attendance, lack of interest and lack of attendance. Fewer than 10 people would come.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have an issue with that timing at all. It's just in terms of whether or not it's actually going to be utilized.
Right. And so,
I don't know that we need to solve that in the legislation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If we just, I mean, our job under the statute is the ordinance to oversee. And so if we just say it's mandatory training, then you just leave it to our training specialists on how exactly they're going to do that. We can certainly encourage that to the extent possible they should have in-person training, but let Andrea figure out if there's somebody who needs an exception.
Yeah, well, I'll see the legislation too, like within a time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm just like, you have to do it in 30 days.
So
I see.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay.
The only thing about the time frame that was discussed is boards and commission, the city's really big on being consistent in their things. So the requirement right now for boards and commission members is they get it within the 6 months of being appointed. So that's not to say that your lobbyist can't have a shorter time period. I'm just saying that that might raise questions at council as to why there's an inconsistent time period.
So if they get a packet that they have to sign off on, maybe that'll suffice.
And most people do it within probably the first 3 or 4 months anyway. But there are some that
take their time.
So I would say to be consistent.
Yeah.
To do the 6 months to be consistent with the rest.
Very good.
Do we want larger question about that later. Do we want the political consultants' requirements to be consistent with the lobbyists? Because you are going to have a lot of standard people.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say they're different, but they'll have people within the same office that are doing the same thing. So, again, for consistency, do we want to have, I want to recommend perhaps the same training, the same types of reporting requirements for the consultants?
Yeah, you could definitely do that. And one thing about the registration, and this is, you don't need to take your time up with it, just it's more for educational purposes. Because it's all online in an app, it's designed where they're literally standing in city council or before the planning commission or a planning member, and they can register right then and start lobbying. So if you're adding this training requirement where they have to read something, we're going to have to find a way to meld that electronically with the registration system. So
maybe they just need to suck it up and come to training. To a daytime training. Right, because if they can register right then and start speaking with no training, what's to prevent them from continually doing that? So maybe I think if we can't change that rule that they can register and then immediately start speaking, right?
You could change the lobbyist registration rules and training requirements that's in the local code. It's in section 801, yeah. You can, I don't, that part about saying you can register and immediately do it is not in there. It's just that in practice that's how it works because it requires the registration before they start to try to influence. So there are some, there we know that there are some people that do it as they're walking into a meeting.
Any training requirement is an improvement.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think I would much rather have any of those groups, lobbyists or local consultants, that they register before they speak and start lobbying and have to be trained. Because that's going to give them incentive to actually get the training. Mm-hmm. Come to a daytime training, get it done, so they can actually start earning some money. Money incentives.
I don't disagree with what you said, but I'm going to play like the devil's advocate, which is if the next training isn't for 45 days, is that, do we impede that person's ability to work?
Perhaps, but since training is given every month, then they need to become trained. Right, because really it's about transparency and about making people accountable. Right? And I think we could avoid the problem of people not having ethics training by mixing that registration and immediately being able to lobby. Right? If they register and they are required to have training, then we know that the minute they start lobbying, they can have that ethics training. Right? They know what the rules are.
I just don't know if that's going to pass.
Might not.
I'm just trying to be a little realistic about whether that would make it through council, and I think it probably wouldn't. What we could do is have a certification that they've read the provisions,
mm-hmm.
you know, to start, and then have a sort of conditional admission, right? The way Florida Bar would, if you came in with some kind of issue, you could have a conditional admission that you could do this for 60 days, and then it automatically expires unless you satisfy your training requirement. But I agree entirely with the principle. I would love to have it be that you need the education to start. I'm a little bit pessimistic about the odds of that making it through council.
So something along the lines of what Ellen was proposing with that educational packet, but having it available both virtually, so they'd have electronic certification, and they'd actually have to go through it, not just skip to the bottom, they have to go through it and sign off and certify. But then also require, I would say, but before, the Joint Commission requires us to do training, virtual training, before we start a job, and that includes some compliance and ethics training and fire safety and a whole bunch of things, right? And so we're not eligible for hire until we do that. So I don't think a virtual sign off and then a follow up training requirement is really asking too much.
And it'd be consistent with boards and commissions members too.
Yep.
And the lobbyists are in City Hall constantly anyway. When they register and you say they speak right away, is it only at the city council meeting? Are they also, because I know there's some that come to my meeting here, and I know some that come to Page's Planning Commission here. Are they registering right before then as well, or is it just at the city council meeting?
And it applies to any employee or any board that they're seeking to influence governmental decision-making in the city. And some register far in advance. But one of the reasons the app was developed was to allow people who maybe didn't know about that or learn of it as they're going to talk to somebody, they can quickly register, satisfy that requirement, and continue to lobby.
Yeah, so they're here constantly anyway, and this is where the training would take place in the city hall, so it's something they could add to their schedule when they're here lobbying.
I won't belabor the point. That idea seems so against the point.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it? Anti-thematic, yes. Of like, isn't the point here so that people, including elected officials, know why people are talking to them? And if I hit submit as I'm walking into council member so-and-so's office, then I've defeated the purpose. Right? So it's just, I'm not all that concerned about preserving the ability to hit submit as you're sitting in the lobby waiting to go meet with somebody. And I think that defeats the point of the database, which is to allow elected officials and staff and others to be able to, you know, as Carlton's sitting in the office, or me, they can look on the database and say, do I have an idea whose interests are in mind here for this meeting that's coming up? And so that part of it doesn't really bother me. But what does bother me is more Ellen's point that you could essentially, a bill could go through an entire council cycle and a lobbyist not be able to do anything about it because they can't get to a training.
Right.
So I'm not all that concerned about the contemporaneous aspect. So if they have to submit a registration and, you know, an application online, and the next morning they get an email with a packet, and they have to respond saying, I've read it and I agree to it, and schedule the training, for, and then they can start. I think a day, two, three, or five lag is not a big deal. 60 days could be a big deal.
For sure. Yeah, and there are a number of lobbyists that call our office from Washington, D.C. So there are a number of lobbyists that are not local. So requiring in-person training is probably not good, consistent for everybody, feasible for everyone. So.
Miserably in my attempt to have a meeting last 30 minutes. Over time, it almost feels like happy hour. So I'm here. Any further comment before we close the meeting?
Yeah. I invited myself to the meeting to thank you all for everything that you're doing, and to offer you my support. Thank you for sharing and for the interesting discussion. In full transparency, at the Complaints Committee meeting yesterday, I said that was my favorite committee, and it was one I was on. But I loved this meeting today, and I may have to evaluate my assessment. I really enjoyed the conversation. I feel like I learned a lot. You're in competition with my former favorite complaint.
Thank
you for everything you're doing.
Thank you.
And so, what time is it, please?
5:18.
I entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Great. Thank you all.
Thank you.